for episode 80 of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak with the world's best artists about creating works of nonfiction. I spoke with Rachel Wilkinson, a writer and researcher based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Her essay, Search History, won Best Essay for Creative Nonfiction Magazine's Science and Religion Contest for issue 65. It's Google as religion or religious experience, how the very act of asking questions is very faith-based, and if we're getting grim and dystopian, how this technology, which is getting increasingly sentient, might supplant us all someday. Hashtag spit out the bone. Metallica reference for y'all. In our conversation, we talk a lot about how she crafted this essay and how it hangs on a big idea rather than sheer character drive. Also, some David Foster Wallace, The War of Art, written by Stephen Pressfield, the fun of research, embracing failure, and trusting, yes, trusting, self-doubt. Self-doubt, you might say, is my spirit animal. So, hey, you digging the show? I'd love if you subscribed to the show or shared it with a fellow CNFer. Leave an honest review on iTunes, and I'll give you an editorial consult on the house. Just send me a screenshot of your review, and I will reach out. Thanks for listening. Why wait? Here's Rachel Wilkinson.
Yeah, it was a shock when that email came through. I actually screamed. I was at work, and I actually screamed. Because I submitted that piece 8 months ago, didn't hear a peep, and, you know, you usually just figure that means it's a no. So I'd honestly forgotten about it. Yeah. And then I interned there years ago, the first year of my MFA, and, you know, done a little bit of reading for them. And it's always been a dream of mine to be published in the magazine at all, and, you know, much less like intern for them. And so to be published at all, and then to win the contest for a significant amount of money, it was like all a little bit too much to process. But I was really, really deeply honored, and they seemed really happy to be able to give it to me. And so it was this really nice, this nice like pairing of people feeling great about it. So
the title of the essay is Search History, and for people who might not be familiar with it, why don't you like kind of give a synopsis of what it is, and then after that talk a little bit about how you arrived at this as an essay you wanted to explore.
It's funny you say that, because I remember very distinctly trying to tell people the concept of this essay, like at parties, and I would just get these puzzled looks. Yeah. I'd just be like, you know, you search stuff online and it's kind of personal and maybe a little spiritual, and that's maybe like certain religious traditions. People would be like, what are you talking about? Google searches? Like, how I look up stuff about my cat? And I was just like, well, maybe there's like a spiritual component to that. Yeah, I guess the pitch for it, now that I've had some distance from writing it, is that it was intended to explore search in all its kind of meanings. Search has this very technical computer science term for when you actually type a query into a search engine, you know, which is a relatively new invention in the last 20 years, but then has this long religious history of going out and going on pilgrimages and going and looking at relics to sort of find enlightenment or higher spiritual purpose. So I don't know. My Google searches always felt intensely personal and kind of more in that older tradition. And I wanted to see what would happen if you sort of held those concepts up next to each other and wed them. And that's how the essay was born.
Hmm. And what was the machinations and the process like working through this as, you know, as you're searching for a thread through this whole piece that, you know, that does explore a lot of those, you know, those deeper questions, or at least the need to, or the historical need to want to ask questions. And it just happens that we have like search engines now, and that's a vehicle for those kind of questions. So like, how did you work your way through this so it felt cohesive and made sense to you and then ultimately readers?
Oh, gosh. As a researcher, you know, which is also my sort of professional day job, I am very guilty of sort of over researching, especially when it comes to personal essay. I have a history of being like, well, I'm going to write about whatever concept, you know, search, the apology, an autopsy. And I'm like, well, I guess I have to go out and read about the entire history of this thing in the West and before. And there was definitely some over researching going on. So I think I started with the most kind of technical aspects of it, like how, what actually happens when you type a query into Google. And it is highly, highly technical for this that I learned. I have no computer science background, for this thing that appears sort of easy and magical to the user. You know, there was years of advanced, groundbreaking computer science that went into it and is still going into it. So I think I started with the tech, the stuff you could really get a handle on practically. And so much emerged out of that almost. I interviewed Scott Fallman at Carnegie Mellon, who I actually wrote a separate story about because he is the person who invented the emoticon. And he, yeah, which is its own, definitely its own story with spiritual components in it. Because he was very unimpressed with Google. I was kind of like, you should read this and this and this and this, and this will bring you closer to the sort of AI spiritual revolution that I envision. And then at the same time, I was kind of interrogating my own personal history with asking questions. So I was writing little personal bits about what it was like to be a philosophy major in college with all its like pretension and downfalls. And I don't know. I just, yeah, I kept coming back to the concept of kind of switching between them, like trying to do a hybrid essay. And I played with that and played with that. I mean, for years, some sections were written 3 years after I first started writing it. And I still don't know that it has an ending, what the ending is. So, yeah, it remains, I mean, still, I guess any writer would say this about any piece, but it remains a work that's in progress that was kind of abandoned rather than finished.
And for those who haven't read it yet, there's this part, like you open it by saying that, you know, some people run or meditate, or your brother had a little Zen rock garden. And for you, as a way of checking in and maybe its own form of meditation was typing these questions into a search bar, and everything from, you know, like how many beats does a blue whale's heart beat in a minute to just asking why. And these days I think we're also so used to punching things into a search bar as well that, you know, we might just circuitously write something that is near what we're trying to ask, and then it drops down and be like, oh yeah, there's the question. It goes like, and immediately you're kind of struck by, oh, someone else in the world has been asking the same exact thing. So I wonder for you, like when you're typing those kind of questions in and then the exact question you are asking pops up, do you feel like connected in some sense? Or maybe you feel like, oh, someone else's thing, maybe I'm not as unique as I thought.
Oh gosh. I think I write this line. It always has made me feel less alone, especially now that we have a WikiHow about everything. Right. I mean, literally just like how to talk to people at parties. We have multiple WikiHows on that. And the Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh recently ran this like newspaper article, and it was maybe a little bit, there was like a little derisive edge to it about how millennials are learning all their life skills through the internet, and how much of a shame it is that you have millennials Googling how to carve a turkey at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, well, how else? Like, I understood the point of this tradition of learning maybe from generations before you has maybe been a little lost, but also like everyone can Google how to carve a turkey and just know and have like multiple sources of information that are not conflicting, or like, you know, your dad's crazy way that may or may not be reliable. So I felt both those impulses. Like I'm a person typing something into a computer to ask a question, which is a little bit lonely and impersonal, but at the same time I'm connecting to this source of knowledge that's collective and so vast that it's kind of unimagined by previous generations. So yeah, there's an interesting tension between the fact that it's an impersonal technology in a way, and then it's also intensely personal.
Yeah. It makes me wonder too, if the, so I was kind of like joking with myself not too long ago, like when I don't know what I was trying to solve, but I'm sort of like right at the edge of wanting, like just in terms of my age, I'm at the edge of just ask the internet anything or try to find someone in the past who's done it before. So I'm like right on that edge where there's still sometimes a pull to want to ask my father or someone else how to install a toilet or something. and so like when I came to that realization, like when I, one time I had to have that kind of talk, I don't know if it was a toilet or what, but it was like, oh, I could just ask YouTube and I can just watch the video. So like the internet became like the father I never had in a sense. And so that was like sort of for the question or for the person and the convenience of asking an inquiry, like, oh yeah, that's nice and easy. I wonder what it does to the older generation who used to be asked these questions and used to be the mentors, that, and they're losing their toehold of mentorship to the internet. Like, have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, for sure. And like, can their knowledge be captured in a way that will be preserved? Because obviously the internet will, well, hopefully outlive us all. So yeah. And, you know, and my friends and I, my friends who do kind of ethnography, we talk about kind of going out and preserving some of the stuff that will get lost with time. But also it's kind of like the internet is everybody's dad, because you get not just, you know, your dad's trick to install a toilet. And that's funny you say that, because I often joke I'm like a YouTube homeowner. I'm just like, what do I do? But you get, you know, the kind of the like the best vetted, crowdsourced, both by people and by the search engine version of how to do everything, which is interesting, because do we want our entire lives to be kind of optimized like that? But yeah, I often think like I now, you know, go to a restaurant where I know exactly what everyone has said about it before. And, you know, yeah, people are worried about these questions. Like, do you lose the spontaneity of just like walking into a restaurant? But also, do you lose the spontaneity of getting food poisoning right. while you're traveling? So yeah, I don't know that I have a good answer to that. And then I was talking to somebody too about kind of the end of the essay, where can I spoil it?
Yo, yeah, yes, exactly. Okay. Spoiler alert. Yeah, this isn't Last Jedi or anything.
Okay. So the end of the essay was this really cool critical piece I came across in The New Inquiry in its very beginnings, when it was a magazine that was really interested in doing, I guess, kind of the same work I was trying to do. Like, how do we pair these big, timeless intellectual ideas with just like, I have a Fitbit. What does that mean? And there was one about crossing the singularity, which is this technical term for kind of when the machines and the artificial intelligence outstrip us in terms of intelligence. And the author likens it to when we sort of really enjoy playing with our dogs, feeding our dogs, our pets. And obviously they have certain knowledge about the world, but it's sort of limited, like, you know, and you can have all these arguments about how sentient are dogs, because obviously they experience emotion, they remember things, experiences, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, like, could they operate a search engine? Like, probably not. And the future will be the machines looking at us with the same kind of appreciation that we once felt. So, yeah, like, are we building this thing? It's already sort of bigger and better than us in some ways, though we manage and control it. But, you know, not only might we lose like the knowledge of one person, but we might lose sort of our way of relating to the world as the sort of like most evolved primary way, because the machines might overtake us. But then they might just leave us, like in the end of Her.
Yeah.
That's my fear, where I'm like, they'll overtake us and that'll be it. Like, they'll just take us. Also a spoiler.
Yeah. Yeah. And how did you get your head around? How are you organizing your notes and your thoughts to work your way through this piece? That it doesn't have what you would call it, like that narrative storyline. This is more of like an essay of thoughts and ideas and an argument and so forth. So it doesn't have like that character drive that you see in some essays. So it's more driven by the big thought. And how did you go about structuring this so it just felt nice and smooth and fluid the way it reads? Because it is a wonderful essay, and I'm sorry if I haven't made that clear. I loved it, and I loved the nitty gritty stuff of the technical aspects of how like Google works, and then all, of course, the big inquiries that you were getting into. So how did you go about organizing your thoughts and your notes to make this thing read so well?
Oh gosh, and boy, am I glad that it worked. Because it was not easy. I am a saver of everything. Like, I have these large folders on my desktop with just like little bits of research. Mm-hmm. So I had one of those that was kind of a mess. And yeah, like you're saying, I think that's exactly right. That if there's no character progression, if there's instead an intellectual progression, how do you sort of keep the reader moving forward? Which is something I struggled with, definitely, in revision. And I had a mentor who said something that I think about all the time, which is that what drives fiction is kind of plot and that traditional structure of like climax and then denouement. What drives nonfiction is sort of continuing revelation toward the moment of greatest truth. So if you're writing memoir, you start with you as a kid, even though you're kind of writing you as an adult, and you sort of bring the story up to the most true current version of what you think of events, whatever that is. You start with the child and kind of bring yourself up to the most adult version of yourself. And so I had to kind of do that with myself intellectually. And of course it ends in an ambiguous place, but you know, there's a kid in there in the beginning who really wants, me as a literal little kid, mm-hmm. who really wants solid answers. And for sort of this journey to be concluded and wrapped up in a nice bow. And of course that does not happen. So sort of, I guess the progression of it is learning to live more with this ambiguity, even though we'll see if that ever happens in the full sort of like Zen fullness of life way that I would imagine other people are living. So yeah, that was the progression I tried to frame it around, was that sort of maybe intellectual evolution.
And as a kid, you're asking a lot of questions, and your parents eventually gave you a tape recorder and just said, mm-hmm. like, well, talk into this. And so what, when you opened that present or however it was delivered to you, what was that like? And what was your degree of excitement or confusion or anything when you received that?
I think I knew at the time they were trying to foist me off onto this thing a little bit, uh-huh. onto this machine. I was kind of like, come on. But then once I sort of remember talking into it, I was pretty entertained by myself. And maybe that's a testament to the fact that the act of asking the question and kind of getting it out is the more powerful thing than like having an instant answer. Like the anxiety, I guess, is like partially relieved just by talking and talking and talking about, not necessarily to any kind of like profound conclusion. So I think I was just a really chattier kid than I am an adult. That's interesting. Just like really chatty, outgoing kid that needed a lot of like space to think these things out. And mm-hmm. so it did bring like some relief. And yeah, it was funny. When I was going home and I told somebody I was doing this, they were like, you should find the tapes. And I was like, oh God, I would be embarrassed to just hear this like gibberish.
Yeah. That was one of my questions about like, what were you actually going to, you know, having tapes would be hilarious and fun and cute, I'm sure. But what were some of the, do you remember exactly what you were asking and speaking to the tapes about?
My parents told me actually, when they read the piece, that they of course remembered this, and that it brought them relief as parents, but that I would just a lot like the kid described in the comedy routine. I would just say why to everything. Mm-hmm. Like, and of course there would be no end. And my dad came up with saying Z, like why Z. And I was so thrown by this that it would often sort of like shut things down for a little while. So I imagine there's some of that on there, but it's also a nice little, you know, I don't know if he intended it this way, although both my parents are researchers, so I'm sure they would appreciate it. But, it's sort of a little commentary on the nature of questioning. Like, mm-hmm. You can say why as much as you want, but there's not gonna be an end point, and so you make a little joke out of it. So I remember counting and talking about infinity a lot, just like how high can I count, like numbers go so high, how high can I count until I get tired of this. Just the idea of like an infinite number of numbers was really something that threw me for a loop as a kid. Just like, we can count forever. Like, you really, yeah, you can count forever. So they would let me count until I exhausted myself. Well, this is something I find really charming about kids. Like, I myself do not have kids, so I can like appreciate it and then not have to live with it all the time. So I guess that's important. Right. But yeah, I do love that kids like are just sponges for curiosity, and like wow, a dog, like I want to learn everything about dog, what kind of dog is this, where did it come from, like so I don't know, like I try to sort of connect back to that person who was like fascinated by the idea of counting. Mm-hmm. And try to at least sort of put that in some of my essays, because I think it's easy to not do that as an adult, though that energy can obviously overwhelm parents.
So, you know, you say, you know, your parents are researchers, you're a researcher. What does that mean exactly? You know, so many people, it's like an app, you know, if you play a sport and you weight train, it's like, well, you don't call yourself a lifter. It's just like part of your training. And so a lot of people who write nonfiction, of course, do research, but they wouldn't necessarily call themselves like a researcher. So what does that entail as a vocation?
Some of it is, you know, unglamorous and tedious. You know, your listeners will appreciate, like, spoiler alert, like a lot of writing is very glamorous, unglamorous and tedious. So it's like interviewing people and transcribing tapes and scouring the internet for whatever tiny little fact that is way harder to find than you would think. Like, how many McDonald's were there last year in the whole world? Mm. Just like, where do you go to find that fact? And but the sort of like more the part that I connect to in this deep way is the idea that you can go out and discover stuff. So, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, like, oh, you're typing something into Google. What does that mean? Like, how does that work? You would answer that question. I mean, there's no end to the amount of things you can kind of learn about a specific question. And for my parents, this took the form of more like social science, and just like, if you put a kid in this kind of school environment, what's going to happen? I mean, you can spend years kind of like in the field looking at these questions, answering these questions. There's always more to know. And they always said to me, like, it's called research, like the meaning, like, you search and you search again, you search and you search again, because there's sort of no end to the knowledge you can gain about a specific topic. Yeah, I think of research as this really open-ended, beautiful thing. And I, when I have kind of subbed in my friends' classes, they usually have me come in and talk about research. And I always tell them, like, I think we all think of research as this onerous school thing, like, oh, I got to open a book and figure out when Thomas Jefferson did this, you know, just like searching for boring factoids, essentially. And I was like, no, research is this vehicle that allows you to follow your interest however long you want to follow it. And it should not be boring. The last thing it should be is boring. And if you're bored, your reader's going to be bored for sure.
Yeah.
Some students, it's like they had never sort of heard that or been given the permission to like follow your interest. It's kind of, yeah, an excuse to nerd out, like nerd out to whatever end you want to.
Wow. And it's funny, given that you're, you know, your parents do this kind of work and predated the internet, and you were kind of like, you know, born into a different era where at least the lead dominoes of research are pretty easy because of the internet. And what kind of conversations do you and your parents have, if you guys are talking shop in any sense, about just the craft of doing the, you know, really rigorous research.
Yeah, it's funny because they are, as you said, a different generation. So there are ways in which we have like funny, like, oh, they don't know how to text kind of moments. Uh-huh. But then like they know how to use Excel better than me, and better than any like person my age, I know, better than me millennial. Like, yeah. it puts me to shame. So yeah, conversations about rigorous research. They usually give me ideas for how to search for stuff online. Well, and back when I was sort of more in nonprofit world, they would say, oh, have you looked at this agency? You know, like these people keep data on this for the last 50 years running, or have you been to the library and they like, you know, keep all the census records for da 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 da. So they gave me this appreciation for like searching through hard documents, which is another thing I find Google has maybe obliterated, like this idea, like you just typed into a search engine and the first three results, you know, they're optimized, Google came up with them, that's what you do. But not like, you know, as a researcher, I will like go back through the congressional record to look at how a particular topic evolved in 1986. For a story I was working on, not for me, but in my life as a researcher, I was looking at the history of the gun debate. And you have to go back to like Ronald Reagan 80s, even before that, like 1968 after the Kennedy assassination, to get like sort of the genesis of today's gun debate. Mm. And the idea that you would really dig that far back and read the minutes where you can see the floor debate evolving like in real time. And of course, they don't know the significance back then, but we can look back and say like, all right, this is the beginning. Kennedy got shot and now we need gun control. And what are people saying about this? I think it's something they gave me, like the really deep go back in the primary documents is something that's, I guess, less appreciated with the advent of just like you click and you have Google and that's it.
Yeah.
And so we talk about stuff like that. And then I think I explain to them how culture is happening on Twitter and just like blow their minds. It's just like, did you see this tweet? Because it really is. I'm fascinated by, I do research on Twitter all the time. You know, I think we're in a place where we might like see a war declared on Twitter. So anyone who dismisses Twitter is kind of frivolous. I'm just like, oh no, the entire culture is happening. Mm.
So what does your Twitter research look like?
Well, it's funny. There's some people, you know, I'm a big admirer of Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Who just left Twitter.
Exactly. So we're recording at a time. But like he, and you know, I don't know how he has the patience. I guess he just ran out. Will, you know, people love to try to pick apart and indict his work. And he himself is like a just fantastic, superior researcher. If you want a person who like goes back to the documents and is like, hey, look at this. 150 years ago, this is what we're talking about. So people try to, you know, troll him on Twitter, and that's what he'll do. He will tweet out, you know, a primary document from the Civil War exactly in opposition to whatever someone is arguing and say, like, it was right here, they said it. Here's General Lee saying this thing. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's such a beautiful marriage of research and Twitter. At the same time, it, you know, I guess up until, I hope he comes back, it builds, it like, creates for me this new persona of kind of what a public intellectual is. Like he's using this this medium that is like little quips essentially so fluidly and with such impact on the culture. Like activist work is being done on Twitter, and at the same time like primary document research is being done on Twitter. Like history, like he's creating current history and using past history kind of at the same time in this medium that was meant for like little jokes about cats. I'm fascinated by that. And so I read people's Twitter feeds endlessly to kind of get the sense of what their mission is and what kind of, you know, and like, I think when we look back at something like the election or like, I read that the election overtook it, but at the time, the day after the George Zimmerman verdict in, I guess it was 2013, maybe 2015, was at that time, the day of like greatest social media activity and greatest unfriendings of all, like of all time.
Wow.
And yeah, and I think like if you want to look back at what that day was like as a historian, you're going to want the tweets and you're going to want Facebook. And I myself was not immune. Like I remember that day just like being on debating with like someone's friend's cousin that I didn't know. Like,
yeah.
Sucked into the thrall of social media about like what this event means. So it's going to be, I think, like this vehicle for history in a way that we don't entirely understand yet.
Yeah, it's. I just read Louisa Thomas's biography on Louisa Adams, the wife of John Quincy Adams, and you know, like most biography, it stems from personal diaries and letters and so forth. And it's just, you brought up a good point that what historians might be looking back on this area, this era, about 100 years from now or longer, and like, what if they have the capacity to access the social media feeds going on now? If that's, I'm sure it'll be possible to access. It might be hard, but just like digging through documents, it would be like, well, what a wealth of information about what's going on today that we have. We're too in it to know the context and knows any significance. But imagine 100 or 200 years from now, looking at Facebook and Twitter feeds that happen to be available and what that will glean about the culture at this time. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. But I don't envy those researchers because we
talk about weeds.
Yeah, we get off kind of light, just being like, oh, we have 6 diaries we can look at. But like everyone's Twitter from 2016, like, oh boy.
What about writing and writing true stories appealed to you when you kind of got into this mess?
Yeah, I started out, I think like many nonfiction writers do, in another genre. And I was writing fiction and poetry, but they're really bad and thinly veiled attempts at writing nonfiction. But because nonfiction, I feel like, has only evolved in the last 20 years. I mean, even in the last 5 years, I've seen this incredible renaissance of sort of like long form nonfiction online. I didn't really know how to do it or what it was. And I had a very prescient English teacher hand me a copy in, it would have been junior year of high school, of David Foster Wallace's A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, the essay he wrote about a 7-night Caribbean cruise, which, like, oh my gosh, getting handed David Foster Wallace as a 16-year-old was a little bit intimidating. But I read that essay, you know, dictionary in hand the first time, and I could not believe it. Like, I could not believe this was a thing you could write, that you could write about the experience of being on a cruise, which is kind of absurd and funny. And, you know, just writing comedically about that would have been enough. But he takes pains to, also as a former conflicted philosophy major, like sort of render this essay about what it means to go on a cruise and what it says about us as Americans and patterns of consumption and mass consumption. And you get lines like, the psychic nature of Americans is da, da, da. And I just couldn't, I mean, I must have carried that thing around for weeks, because like I could not believe, like, oh, this is a thing you can write. And that was it. Like, that was the moment I was like, oh my god, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And my family actually got me like a signed copy of that book for my MFA graduation. So sometimes,
wow,
when I'm writing, I like talk to him, which is sad. But the book is on my desk, but I'm just like, it's one of those books I open up and I'm like, all right, okay, I just need to get back to whatever it is that is the thing itself. Like, you can wander, you know, so far afield, but it was writing true stories, but it was also like the idea of using true stories to explore these bigger things, bigger ideas, which is like still, I mean, like an ever evolving genre, like kind of how do you use the truth, air quotes, to tell stories, as much as how do you use like stories to tell the truth? I don't know.
Yeah. It's incredible that, what I love hearing, like you talk about, you know, that particular essay and probably that collection, is I love hearing about the stories or the books that like turn the world Turner Writer's world from Black and White and the color, and show what's possible. And as you revisit those types of his work, and then probably you tried to find, being the researcher you are, you're probably like, well, who then influenced Wallace to write the way he did? So I'm sure you went back to find his influences and so forth. What about his, his particular style, and then maybe offshoots of him, like, really just resonated with you?
Well, there's the level at which, like, he's just an amazing prose stylist, and that I can't imitate. Mm-hmm. And that was not really, I mean, certainly, like, you know, great to behold and read, and like this appreciation for every word counts in a sentence was part of it. But it was more like he just would take these mundane things and elevate them to the level of kind of great discourse in this way where you didn't really know what was happening. The other essay in that book I return to a lot is the one where he's at the Iowa State Fair.
Yeah.
And there are parts of that essay where he's like, just look at these shirts people are wearing. Like, isn't this ridiculous? They're wearing these like shirts with stupid jokes on them. Like, this is what we're talking about. But then it's like, you know, he's very aware we're in a very particular place in history and moment in time. We're like, okay, we're in the Midwest in America, in Iowa, where people are farming. And like, what does it mean to like get together and have a fair? Like, what does that mean? And yeah, it was just that marriage of just like beautiful narrative storytelling and lots of humor with, we can use that as a vehicle to approach these higher things, like meaning making. And like, I feel like still, I mean, certainly he has a lot of offshoots. And I say this knowing that, like, I know there's like this culture of David Foster Wallace fandom.
Yeah.
But I really do feel this like pure connection that I think was developed before all that happened. And I'm definitely more attracted to his nonfiction than his fiction. So I like to like separate myself and be like, okay, I'm not like an Infinite Jest person necessarily. Mm-hmm. There's something about, he just really, you know, I wanted, and I relate to his biography, of course, in this way that is maybe a bit of projection, but there's something about studying philosophy that was really not doing it for me in terms of trying to make meaning out of the world, where I was like, all right, I have this like perfect ontological rendering of this thing that sounds really nice, but like, how does that help me when I'm at the Iowa State Fair? Like, I don't know. And the only way I think you can do that is with narrative. Like the way he did it, you gotta be on the ground. You gotta be like getting sick on the Ferris wheel. And like, then maybe you can pull in some of this bigger stuff. And it was such a, it remains like the model for how to do that. That is interesting to me.
I'm sort of like you. I like his nonfiction better than his fiction, and what I've grown to like even more than his nonfiction is just his interviews that he was that he granted. Like just being able to like just watch a video and hear him talk for 20 minutes or something. Like I just really liked hearing that, and maybe my favorite thing of all is the ebook Quack This Way, the conversation he has with Brian Garner.
I have not read that.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's just about language and grammar. And it's a quick read, but it's something I turn to over again just to hear these two really brilliant writers and just purveyors of the language just go back and forth about what it means to write clearly and just words and word play and just clean grammar. And if you're a word nerd, it's like the thing to read because it's like being able to eavesdrop on a cool conversation about language. And if you're into that kind of thing, which I am, yeah, it's really cool. Fun. It sounds like you dig it too. So yeah, you have this mentor, this English teacher who put that book in your hand. You know, when in moments of doubt in this line of work, you know, who have been some of those people who give you that permission to keep going and who kind of got put fuel in your tank to enable you to keep persisting in the face of what can be just like a untold rejection and so forth.
Well, so I have another book
Nice.
That, yeah. So I read The War of Art.
It's great.
Oh my God. Who is the author?
Stephen Pressfield.
Stephen Pressfield, Legend of Bagger Vance.
Yeah.
that book came to me, after my MFA when, that is, for anyone who has gotten an MFA, post-MFA period can be a very difficult transition. Because you've been supported in your writing and had this community, and then suddenly you got to figure out what the heck you're going to do, sort of more on your own.
Yeah.
So I was in that heavily, and that was when that book came to me. Someone recommended it to me. It might have been one of my former professors, actually. And that book has saved me many times, because he says, I'm going to summarize it. he says, essentially there's nothing else except for love of the work. And he has this great scene where he's just like, you got to be like a Marine. Those guys just love suffering. They love just like being in the muck and it's cold and you got to build a bridge and your boots are failing. And if you don't love that, you're not going to survive. And anything that you've put up against yourself, to detract from that love, he calls kind of resistance, and it manifests in all these different ways: procrastination and being sick and having drama in your life. And all of it is just sort of a distraction from the fact that, you know, you should be doing writing or whatever art appeals to you. I've come back to that book. You know, I had that book inspired me to start sending out work. And then I kind of had my first successful publication in The Atlantic, and just hearing the word The Atlantic to me, you know, mm-hmm. as like the person who read that magazine my entire life, I couldn't believe it. But in the end, I was so happy. But it was like, oh, this piece had a really good 16 hours online.
Yeah.
And, you know, like all my friends called me and said congratulations, which was really nice. And it had a lot of like nice Facebook things said about it. But in the end, it was like less than a day of sort of like praise. And right after that, I was like back at my desk in the muck. And that's when, you know, one of the lessons of that book hit me, where I was like, oh, my God, like if you can't love the work and the grind, you are doomed. Like if you are in it for any kind of other reason, and like especially any sort of like external praise or acclaim or fame or any of that, which I don't know, people who are going after literary fame, I'm always like, you know, that's not like real fame, right? Like you're not Beyonce. Like you sort of top out at a very low level of fame, even if you're literary famous. But even if you're going for that level of fame, it is, you are not going to make it. And I've come back to the book many times just to sort of like re-excite my love for the grind. And there are many times where I'm like procrastinating and doing other things that I know I shouldn't be doing for weeks at a time. And I've been going through one of those periods where I'm like avoiding looking at that book because I know it's going to kick me back into line.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. The work has to be its own reward.
Mm-hmm. There's no other way around it.
Yeah, of course. You're spot on for sure. And it's along those lines of, you know, having being in the muck and so forth. And you know, I always like getting people's definition of what it means to like work, what strong and hard work looks like in this line of work, like that rigor and tenacity. Like, how do you define that? So when you look back on your day, you're like, oh, that was a good day of work.
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Suffering is a really, it's a word that really comes to mind. I don't know. I think, you know, when you have really suffered through a day, mm-hmm. like you have really sat there and thought deeply about, what am I trying to do? I tried to put that on the page and struggled with it. I think that's probably the best you can do. Cause I mean, research is its own kind of productive day, but to me, research is almost kind of a fun distraction from the writing itself, which is maybe why I indulge in it for too long. and it obviously informs the writing and it has its purpose, but it's not the real work in a sense.
Yeah.
Because the real work is sitting and struggling with the material. I think if you've sat and struggled earnestly for any amount of time, that's probably the most productive at least I can be. And I know when it's happened because it feels a certain way. It feels both like perversely bad and good at the same time. It feels like you've done work in the same way. Like it feels like you've like run some sort of marathon mentally. It's funny. I like feel happy afterwards while being miserable in the moment. I don't know if that if anyone can relate to that probably.
When you were an intern and a reader for Creative Nonfiction, what did you take away from that? And what did you learn from reading Slush?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I mean, on sort of a practical level, I appreciated how much, you know, literary magazines to me were just like these magical factories where beautiful stories came out. And of course, I saw the other side of that, which is a grind that is an office on the level of like, oh, there are 17 crazy spreadsheets that someone has to consolidate and understand. So I saw like that, like, oh, this is a small business that, you know, I was like, all right, I'm gonna go through these spreadsheets. But then Creative Nonfiction, but I think because of the name, gives people permission reading the Slush to just kind of send in their diaries. Just like, oh, I was standing at my kitchen table and I was thinking about this time from the 1960s, and here it is. Here's this like little story that I just typed out and sent. So I really started to appreciate creative nonfiction and nonfiction as a craft, because I think people think it's just, you know, like The Moth obviously is out there, although I think those stories are more crafted than we sort of give them credit for, that you can just sort of like tap out any story in any structure in any format without regard to elements like character and plot and voice and like craft elements, and send it off. And so I like, you know, there's so many people writing because they got out of a difficult situation and it was sort of cathartic therapy writing, where I was like, this is great for you. I'm so happy for you. This is not publishable. I really wanted to send them a note and be like, congratulations, you left your marriage, but we can't, like, there's, so I think that's, yeah, to get a crafted piece actually was kind of a rarity. And I came to appreciate like people out there not only try and tell their stories, but craft their stories. I appreciated them quite a bit.
How far along were there some stories that you're like, all right, I can't finish reading this and it's done? Or did you give each one its own little micro dignity of at least finishing it?
I did try to finish all of them. And I think the hardest ones were the ones where they showed promise. And I would go and I'd be like, oh, I see the potential. And Creative Nonfiction being like, you know, a literary magazine who can solicit whoever it wants, they don't want to spend a lot of time editing. And so they would say to me, like, this is going to be great for some other magazine. We don't have the time to kind of work with this person. And I really wanted to like send a nice note that was like, just keep, which is funny because I've gotten those notes. And so now I knew exactly what it was like to be on the other side of those and to take them less personally and take them, you know, as encouragement. But that was hard. When it was a clear, like, someone's diary, I would read it and be like, okay, great for this person, and be able to send like an easy rejection. When it was right on the borderline of like, oh, clearly this person is a writer and they're playing with this still. Yeah, that was when I was like, I really wanted to reach out and be like, if you just maybe just couldn't do it. But yeah, I did try to give their own, unless it was just like a really, I don't know. Sometimes we would get really people's indulgent kind of fantasy pieces where I was like, what is this? I would try to, I like the idea of micro dignity. I would try to afford them all some kind of micro dignity.
So what's your like daily routine look like as you're, you know, sort of warming up to start working on work of this nature? How do you set up your day?
Oh boy. I am not a good model of a writer in the sense that I'm not like Michael Chabon, where I know I'm going to spend this exact 6 hours doing this thing every day. And I have my like, you know, desk where I go away. Like I could improve in this. I work off inspiration a lot more, where I will be either really, really deep into a piece for days and be in this cave where I can't really talk to other people, or I will be researching and doing other things. But it's kind of like I have to make space to sort of descend into the depths by myself. Mm-hmm. And so I will do these sort of like marathon writing days. And I actually perversely really like writing on a deadline because it gives me the space to kind of like shut everybody else out and be like, I'm on a deadline. I'm going to do it. And really, really do a deep dive. Yeah, because I have to commune with some higher thing that's happening. Like, I'm not one of those people that can like write on the bus.
Yeah.
I'm very envious of those people. And like, maybe as I continue to evolve, I'll be a little less precious about stuff like that. But yeah, so my process is I'll be researching a piece forever. I'll be making notes on a piece. It'll be percolating. And then finally, I have to just kind of take the time to shut the door, shut everybody else out, take a couple days and do it. And I'm excited to be home right now, actually, because I have had like a personal piece that has, I've been going through that process forever, and I'm sort of itching to actually sit down with it. And I know it will be painful, but it's been, that percolation takes a really long time for me. And that, you know, in search history too, it's like, I've been talking about that piece at parties for a year, I think, before I like sat down to actually work on it. And then when I did, I was like, oh God, what a mess.
Yeah. Like in your head, I imagine you're talking about it at parties. You had this like perfect vision of it. So it must've been, it just tough to then actually have to sit down and try to manifest that vision in your head.
That was another, I saw Ta-Nehisi Coates give an interview about craft, and he had a line that was like, everything always sounds cooler when you're talking about it with your friends at the bar. Like the true like sort of test is when you get home and you're like, that is not as cool as I thought. But I thought like, okay, if Ta-Nehisi Coates experiences this, I feel good about it.
So what are, you know, you mentioned the supposedly fun thing in War of Art. Are there any other books that you like to revisit and reread to remind yourself how it's done and, or to inspire you to do the work that, that you find most engaging?
Ulibis's Notes from No Man's Land to me is almost a perfect book of essays. And the same thing where like, she just weds the personal to the political and the philosophical and just like perfectly, just, I don't know how, because her voice, I feel like, is even kind of more seamless than his in some ways. Like, you don't even realize you're talking about, you know, the history of race relations in America before it's happening. And I've come back to that book so many times. I've taught that book and I don't even really know how to teach it, because I'm just like, how did she do this?
You're like, come on, students, I'm asking you. I don't know how they do it.
Yeah. She was at AWP 2015, she was on a panel with Claudia Rankine, Maggie Nelson, and Leslie Jameson. It was the four of them. And it was like too much star power in one room for me. And I don't actually, the panel was like okay, because I think there's actually too much star power in one.
Yeah, it's like the room. Avengers of star, of yeah, of panels.
Yeah, yeah. But those four writers and like, you know, women writers so close to my heart, oh man, do they get it. So their books too are ones that I come back to all the time. And I do feel like whoever put them together, and it was probably like Grey Wolf put them together, they are coming at writing, I feel like, from the same way where it's political but it's personal, but it is concerned with like art and craft. And, you know, Claudia Rankine in Citizen and her first book, Don't Let Me Be Lonely, which is another one I come back to, just like, it's almost prose poetry more than essay. I mean, I think it's sold as poetry, but it is like beautiful nonfiction and gives me an appreciation for like, you're looking at your TV, how is that political and historical? Like, and how do you write that in like 200 words, like a little 200 word bit? It's like, yeah, beautiful. Yeah. So, yeah.
And it clearly, you know, research is a strength of yours and something that you can even become a form of productive procrastination in a sense, you know, over-researching. What else might you identify as a strength of yours and also a weakness? And knowing that, which ones do you tend to lean into you know, leveling up your weaknesses or leaning more into your strengths?
I know that I'm kind of a heady cerebral writer, and a lot of what I worked on in, you know, during my MFA, and this sounds like so cliche therapy kind of stuff, but I really had to work into being more explicit about the personal, because people would be like, all right, it's not a philosophy essay. I would be like, well, isn't it though? Like, we need, you know, I feel like it's often the opposite, where it's like people are just writing, you know, one of my professors used to call it like the classic kind of mom essay. Like, people are just writing endlessly about their mom and it's sad and that's it. I needed more mom essay, more sad mom essay. And you know, even in editing for this piece, and that was literally a note I got that was like, we need more you, we need more parents, we need more this. And I was like, well, I gave you guys my search history. It feels really personal to me. but, you know, it was not, yeah, people want blood. So to give them a little more blood. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's something Eula Biss is really good at, and Claudia Rankine is really good. Maggie Nelson is certainly really good at, even as she weds, really high level criticism to whatever she's writing. There are moments where she's just like, and here's what my body was doing. And you're like, oh my God. So yeah, that's a weakness I try to lean into. In fact, for this year, I'm trying to just write personal essays. It's really hard not to be like, oh no, I'm going to go research. I'm right now trying to write an essay about cats, because it is so saccharine and personal and stupid to just kind of play around with that.
Yeah.
But I'm very tempted to just be like, well, let's research Egypt and cats. And but I'm trying to stay in the personal a little bit more, because I think I've been so into research. Gosh, it's hard to name your own strengths. I feel like this is a question we should be asking other people. So
in the last couple of years, is there a particular behavior or habit that you feel like has improved your work or your life in any way?
I started meeting with what we have been calling an intentions group, which is, you know, four writers, and we were all in the same MFA program together, get together, you know, once a week on Sunday and say, here's what I'm working on. And in fact, I've told them they need to crack the whip and hold me more accountable and be like, why didn't you do your intentions?
Yeah.
But it's having that, again, post MFA is a tough time for a lot of people. Having that community for just even that brief moment every week has meant a lot to me. And we do help each other out. Someone will say, I'm having trouble doing this kind of research, or I'm having trouble structuring the story this way, and what do you guys think is interesting about it? Or who do you think I should go talk to next? And, or I'm having trouble with this pitch. And, we do kind of help each other out, and just having that space, you know, I've had a lot of weeks recently where I was like, I'm really failing. And there's a space for other people to say, I get it. And kind of, I forgive you, or I give you permission to kind of forgive yourself. So that has helped. And I need to lean more heavily on that, I think. But just having that little bit of community has been really helpful to me. And that's, you know, writers will tell you again and again and again the importance of community, but to build it took me some time.
Yeah. In those moments when you're feeling like you're failing, what kind of self-talk do you use? Like, in the absence of the group, you know, what kind of self-talk have you used to I don't know, if you find yourself down like that, to bring yourself back up, and so you can still continue to do what it is you love?
I think that's when I have to go back to the Marine mindset of number one, no one's going to die. Yeah. You're not actually in the Marines. Keep in perspective, no one's going to die. Thankfully, and it's my barometer of success, but I've had enough publishing success at this point that I can say this is part of the process, and I know it will work out. It's a long game almost every time, and very hard to see, but I was just failure is actually part of the process. And so when I'm failing, I think all right, I'm at the part where I'm failing. I'm at the failure portion. We'll see how long this lasts. And yeah, Jean Marie Laskis is my mentor and for whom I'm a researcher. And I asked her once, you know, in her like long career, like, what have you learned? And she said, she was like, I must have gotten better as a writer. I don't really remember getting better, but I must have just by like the sheer amount of time. And she was like, what I have learned is to like trust these phases of failure, like trust the self-doubt. And it's true that like even watching her, and this has been nice to peel back the curtain on a super successful writer, where she's just like, this is a hell of a thing I chose to make a living. Wow, this is hard. This is a lot. she has those moments too where I'm just like, all right, it's all of us. And just like, you know, being on deadline and not knowing really what you're even writing is like a thing that's common to everybody. And yeah, so I guess the short answer is perspective is to how I try to deal with failure.
Yeah, what a gift to be able to be that close to a mentor too, in that sense, to see someone that you admire who's like in the muck and just doesn't sometimes know how it's going to turn out, but clearly just by showing up has gotten better and better and better and is playing the long game. I think you hit it on the head. It's like you really have to see this as something, as a lifelong thing where you never master it, but you do. By writing every single day and reading more and more, you do become better over time. And it is something you don't just drop in and parachute in and become some brilliant, well-read person. Like, you actually just have to keep showing up, get in the muck and do the work. And yes, you will improve over time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think with anything, which I find weirdly comforting, it's like there's some truth to the 10,000 hours thing.
Yeah, of course, of course. Well, you know, Rachel, this has been a lovely conversation, and I'd love to talk for another hour, but I got to be mindful of your time, and maybe we can do a part two and dig into some other stuff that I've drawn up. But in this case, I think this is a great place to end our first conversation of what I hope will be many down the road. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
Right, that's another episode in the books. What a fun person to talk to, don't you think? Yeah, I hope you had as good a time as I did learning about Rachel and her work. Go follow her on Twitter. I can't really read her Twitter handle name, not because it's profane or anything, but because I really don't know how to say it. So go to her website, rachelmwilkinson.com. And you will learn all sorts of good stuff about Rachel and her work, and also find her Twitter link, which maybe you can tweet at her and ask her how to say it. Show notes for episode 81 and all episodes of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast appear at brendanomera.com. There you can subscribe to my growing monthly newsletter, where I send out my reading recommendations for the month, as well as what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. So, get this. My wife was knitting the other day, so I knew she couldn't get away, and I made her listen to an episode of the podcast. And you know what her reaction was?
Suffering is a really... it's a word that really comes to mind.
I'm Brendan O'Mara, and I'll see you right back here next week for another CNFN episode of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. The last one of 2017. Can you believe it? Thanks for listening.